You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Adam Rafiq, and I'm your host. On February 14th, nearly 170 million Indonesians went to the polls to choose their next president. The final vote count is not yet in, but the preliminary results show a clear winner, Prabowo Subianto. Prabowo, as he's known, will be the next president of this rising Southeast Asian country, an archipelago that stretches thousands of miles wide and is home to more than 270 million people. A former general with a troubling past, Prabowo has launched numerous failed bids for higher office since 2009. And this time around, he's finally proved to be successful. Using TikTok, this general, who was once barred from the U.S. for allegedly ordering the killing of pro-democracy protesters, has rebranded himself as a cuddly grandpa who'll continue the policies of his former rival, the popular outgoing president Joko Widodo. Jokowi, as he's known, is barred by term limits for running for a third term. But he gave Prabowo a tacit endorsement when one of his sons joined the ex-general as his running mate. Now, these elections mark the end of Jokowi's formal rule over Indonesia. But there are indications that he's now transitioning to another role in Indonesia's oligarchic dynastic political system, that of kingmaker. Jokowi's transformation from a middle-class furniture maker to an unlikely president and finally to one of Indonesia's many dynastic leaders raises questions over the health of this flawed and messy democracy and who will wield power in this emerging Southeast Asian economic giant. To unpack all this, we're joined by Dr. Jackie Baker, a lecturer at Australia's Murdoch University and a longtime researcher on Indonesia's politics. Dr. Baker, thanks for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure, Arif.
So with 77% of the results in at the time of our recording, Prabowo Subianto has secured 59% of the vote, all but confirming that he will be Indonesia's next president. Now, Prabowo has been seeking the presidency since 2004, and he's been part of three failed presidential tickets since 2009. What was behind his success this time around?
Well, clearly it's the Jokowi factor, right? So Jokowi, President Joko Widodo, was looking for a successor for his to shore up his legacy and found that his own political party, with whom he had long had fractious relationships, that party is known as the Party of Democratic Struggle. And it's a dynastic party whose roots trace back to Sukarno and the period of Indonesia's independence. So it's a party of great entitlement and privilege and sees itself as the vanguard of democracy whilst not acting very democratic. And its head, Megawati Sukarnoputri, daughter of Sukarno, she always made it clear that Jokowi was only ever in power because of she bestowed that upon him, and that he was nothing but a mere member of the party and that he added really very little to the party's agenda. And so he was just a figurehead of a president for the exercise of her power and her party's power. And I think, you know, two terms of that kind of disparagement ultimately saw Joko Widodo seek another heir outside of his nominated party. This is what led him into the arms of Prabowo Subianto. Now, of course, they had had a kind of reconciliation after the 2019 election, wherein Prabowo Subianto joined the Jokowi cabinet. So you think of two sort of enemies having these horrible, bruising elections. They seemed like an enemy, you know, a split of all of the ages within Indonesian democratic politics. And then suddenly Prabowo turns around and flips and enters the Jokowi Widodo cabinet as Minister of Defence. This is a classic tactic from the president. He likes to pacify by bringing people on board to his agenda, by sharing out the spoils of power. So Joko Widodo and Prabowo Subianto had some kind of reconciliation starting 2019. So when it came to 2022, 2023, and Joko Widodo was scouting around for an heir, having exhausted all other possible alternatives for extending his own presidency, including mulling a very illegal third term, he found himself in the arms of Prabowo Subianto, who had pitched that he would run with Jokowi Widodo's own son, Gibra Raka Raka Buming. And I think the temptation of that, plus the kind of push factors of his own party's truculence, led him to make an alliance with Prabowo. Prabowo's own massive success in winning this election comes in large part because Joko Widodo was able to give him the sort of blessings of a highly favoured president whose own popularity ratings were up in the 80% or something, giving the president a kind of cache of voters who were looking for his endorsement. And Prabowo Subianto won that endorsement.
Right. And so we have a mix of factors that explain Prabowo's victory. You've talked about the Joko Widodo factor, and we'll unpack that a bit more later. But there's also an element of rebranding of Prabowo. He's someone, you know, who has a military background, has been implicated in crimes against civilians in terms of targeting democratic protesters, minorities in regions like East Timor. But he's rebranded himself as more of, you know, affable, grandfatherly figure. And what I found interesting was that according to exit polls, there's one exit poll by Kompas, an Indonesian newspaper, Prabowo won nearly 66% of the Gen Z vote. And this is an older man with a pretty horrible human rights record, and he performed best among younger voters. And that belies the thinking about, you know, younger voters tending to be more idealistic and change-oriented. So what explains all this? There's talk of TikTok playing a role in terms of the rebranding of Prabowo. Is the story that, you know, there's just a bunch of kids who are tricked into voting for him using TikTok, or is there much more to this? And you've kind of hinted at this with the Joko Widodo factor.
Well, certainly, you know, Prabowo Subianto was the prime candidate across all age categories. So he was winning across all, you know, the various categories of age in amongst the voting cohort. However, as the cohort got older, so, you know, 50 to 60, 60 to 70, his margin of success became lower and lower. So it was a kind of absolute inverse with Gen Z, where he was the absolute highest. He had, as you said, 67%. Some people put that up in the previous polls prior to the election. Some people put that up to 70%+ that he that he received favor from the Gen Z cohort. I think, you know, is there something fatally wrong with the Gen Zs of Indonesia? I mean, no. I think that we still do see a very idealistic group of Gen Zs. It's worth noting that Gen Zs across the campuses made an incredibly hard push throughout the Jokowi Widodo presidency for democracy, arguing that reformasi, or the social democratic revolution that had happened in 1998, was collapsing and that had been betrayed. So there were enormous efforts to stymie the voices of Gen Z, who were largely, arguably, elite voices, voices from the campuses, people who were able to study, which is still a very small percentage of Gen Z. But Gen Z is still, you know, the backbone of, I guess, activist movements. But those groups were crushed by the Jokowi Widodo administration and broken up. And the universities were very complicit in silencing those voices. Nonetheless, in the days before the election, again, the campuses erupted, this time in partnership with the lecturers, trying to push for an anti-Prabowo vote, sort of anyone but Prabowo, reminding people that democracy was a central win of the 1998 revolution and that it deserved to be protected. So I guess, you know, while Gen Z did certainly plump for this rebranded cuddly Uncle Prabowo, there are certainly elements of Gen Z that were incredibly hostile to his re-election. I mean, a lot of people put the large numbers of Gen Z voting for Prabowo to an absence of knowledge about democracy. I think that's probably a little glib. I think more likely is that you have very large numbers of Gen Z who probably don't see great prospects, who are undereducated, who don't see where they fit into the wider economy. And in that context of a large, floating, unemployed, low-skilled group cohort of individuals, you know, strongmen can really appeal, especially strongmen who have been endorsed by a president that they largely see as having driven a very successful economic development of Indonesia. So I guess it's a mixed picture. And the shorthand answer is that a lot of young people probably didn't care, or a lot of young people were more concerned about shoring up their futures and saw that future with a strong man like Prabowo Subianto.
Yeah, and maybe I should be less dismissive of this Gen Z TikTok voter demographic. Now, as you had said, Prabowo was to a large extent riding in the coattails of Joko Widodo and also signaling continuity of his developmentalist agenda. So one of Prabowo's signature programs, a free school lunch and milk program, which could cost at least $7 billion or close to $8 billion in its first year, roughly 2% of GDP, signals that for a large number of voters, especially the young, these kind of social welfare spending, along with ensuring jobs for new entrants into the labor market, are pretty important. Do you feel that this points towards a kind of precarity or economic security among Indonesia's middle and lower middle classes? Because, you know, we hear a lot about rapid growth at top level, but this is also a very unequal society. And in terms of the spoils of this growth, it's not really distributed fairly. So underlying all this, is there economic insecurity that is a major political force, not just in this election, but in Indonesian politics in general?
Absolutely. I think that's what's underlying the current Jokowi Widodo government, and that will underlie the dynamics of future governments, is the fact that Indonesia's economic growth is very poorly distributed. In fact, some people argue that most of, you know, something 90% of Indonesia's wealth lies in the hands of 1% of its population. And that may have changed somewhat over the last few years, but there is nonetheless a very large group of Indonesians, somewhere up to 40%, who live with a constant feeling of precarity. So Indonesia is the kind of success story of Southeast Asia in terms of its ability to drive down poverty. And Indonesia has almost eradicated, in fact, extreme poverty. But with that comes new political challenges and new political realities, which is that you have brought on enormous numbers of people with you in your government on the promise that they too can be middle class. But often, you know, the nature of neoliberal economic growth means that you have to have a level of flexibility within the workplace and deregulation within the workplace that makes those secure, stable, middle class jobs very, very difficult to achieve. On top of the fact that there are also major issues with Indonesian education system, where quality of education is quite low. It has been a system that has been focused on rolling out schools as opposed to providing quality education. And that's also at the tertiary level. So what you have are people of a kind of lower middle class, or precarious middle class is the word I like to use, investing in low quality education that doesn't actually translate into stable jobs for their young people, right, for their children. And this is a point of absolute frustration, and it's well recognized, I think, by parents. And I think in politics, there's nothing so dangerous as a dashed aspiration, as a promise of something better that never appears, you know? And I often see this precarious working class within Indonesia as feeling like they're on the way to middle class, but never really getting there. They're on a hamster wheel of precarious short-term contract jobs. And that's been amplified by the rise in services like Gojek, which is kind of a rideshare program, application, and other types of sort of low paid courier work, which seems to absorb a lot of Indonesia's working poor, particularly in the cities, for instance. And so I think you've got very large heaving cities within Indonesia with large levels, large numbers, up to 40 to 50% of people who are watching the city grow around them, watching the trappings of wealth amplify around them, and are being shut out of that promise. And they can feel it themselves as rents go up, as the cost of education goes up, as they become more and more vulnerable to kind of scams being offered at the lower middle class and in the middle class, offering them, again, this will be the way to become rich. And this will be the way to shore up your child's education. And they don't really provide, or they tend to be very low quality services. And so I think this is a real problem for many middle income countries who have promised their populations a middle class, a developed world economy. And yet only some people are using the kind of the ideology of that economy and the method and the strategies for developing that economy towards a developed economy. That means that a lot of people's hopes are going to be dashed along the way. It's worth remembering that a safe, secure middle class is the backbone of democracy. And often that's come about through labor rights. And in Indonesia, labor rights are very, very precarious, and unions have a very mixed record in terms of delivering for workers.
Right. And the COVID pandemic itself was a reminder to many in Indonesia, India, and many other emerging markets or middle-income countries of how precarious much of their populations are, that there are many people, hundreds of millions of people who exist just above the poverty line. And all it takes is a pandemic or a sharp economic downturn for them to re-experience the poverty that they had experienced in their lifetimes, or maybe their ancestors had. And so, you know, for a lot of these countries, there's not just the potential for the middle income trap, but also for the regression for some in the event of a deep-seated economic crisis. And that's why we see politicians like Modi in India, who's seen as center-right economically, actually deploy social welfare spending as a big part of his economic agenda. And it's had tremendous benefits in terms of the electoral politics as well.
That's a good point. That said, in Indonesia, the social welfare spending has not been aimed towards the working poor. Primarily, the social welfare spending is for the poorest of the poor, which is still somewhere in the vicinity of 10%. Nonetheless, so I think what the working poor and the lower middle class need in order to stabilize and get see their prospects increase is better education and health. And these are areas that are incredibly difficult to transform, that are riddled with vested interests, and that in themselves are very nutty policy problems. And I think Jokowi has been right to emphasize education and health in his previous two terms, but he has had to make political compromises that has meant that both of those sectors have not reformed in a way that is fast enough or that will bring about change for those demographics. So I think that managing this the aspirations of a lower working class who believe fervently that they will make it to middle class is vital. And then we saw during the pandemic, we saw many of that working poor, that sort of the striving class, right, the aspirational class, actually spend up all of their savings in order to keep afloat. So it doesn't even take an economic downturn to rock these people, right? It takes a cancer diagnosis or, an ill parent or the loss of a bond on a rental property, and they are thrust back into poverty. So it's worth noting that, the precarity has really increased after the pandemic as people's the little assets that they had were sold in order to keep families afloat during the pandemic.
Right. And skills development are key to greater productivity and rising towards being a, you know, an upper income economy. And that transition really requires deep-seated reforms to the education system. And this is a big country, 270 million people. So to do that at scale is a phenomenal task. Now, getting back to Prabowo, he's been alleged to have been involved in massacres in East Timor, going back to at least the 1980s, the abduction of pro-democracy activists in 1998, and the murder and sexual violence targeting Chinese communities in that year as well. And when I read about Prabowo, the image that comes to mind is an Indonesian Duterte. Maybe that's a forced analogy on my part, but you know, there is a profile of him on the investigative news website, The Intercept, and the author recalls an interview with him from 2001 in which Prabowo says, Indonesia is not ready for democracy. The country needs a benign authoritarian regime. So is Prabowo really a changed man?
That's the million-dollar question, Arif. It's a great question, and that's the question everyone's asking. I think there's sort of two schools of thought. On one side, you've got people who speak to Prabowo Subianto's character, and he is a blue blood who made his way to the absolute tip of the spear in terms of the military under the New Order, was incredibly close to the New Order family, Suharto, married into the family itself, married Titi Suharto, although they eventually divorced. He's a man who has long had the ambition of being president. He's a man who believes he knows what's best for the country, particularly in terms of foreign policy and defense strategy. And he's also a man with whose temperament is well known. He tends to be very aggressive when challenged. He loses his temper very easily. It's worth noting that some of his previous running mates, say Santiago Uno, have refused to work with him again on this in this current presidential campaign. So he makes enemies, and some people feel that he has betrayed them or sold them out. Nonetheless, so some people argue, right, that you can't sort of, a tiger can't change his stripes or, you know, and you can't sort of change the fundamental character of a person. It's worth noting, however, that Prabowo has found success as a centrist. And he has rebranded himself as Cuddly Uncle, who has very centralist, moderate, sort of centre-right economic ideas. That's what he puts on his sort of core policy platform. However, when confronted or when provoked on the hustings, you know, out in the campaign, we certainly see old Prabowo kind of sticking his head through, and you hear discussion around or sort of angry thumping around, you know, our sovereignty and foreigners are taking our land and what have you. So there's kind of a Prabowo, there's certainly an internal Prabowo who may be busting to get out, and a Prabowo that is deeply authoritarian, a Prabowo that truly, I agree with you, does not believe that democracy is appropriate in a country like Indonesia. He's also shored up by his party, Gerindra, or the Greater National Indonesia Party. And that party has long held in its manifesto that it should wind back democratic elections at the local level, so at the city, mayoral, regency, and provincial levels, where Indonesians get to elect their directly elect their governors and what have you. And Prabowo believes and is increasingly turning the political elite to his position. That those forms of democracy are messy, corrupt, and they should be wound back. There's also been some discussion, and it included during the campaign, that Indonesia shouldn't really be directly electing its presidential candidates. So winding back the direct elections for the president, which is one of the core wins of the Reformasi movement, has been something that's been discussed and promoted by his allies. They would prefer a system that returns to the new order, wherein a kind of expanded legislature, what we might think of as the second chamber of the legislature, would nominate a president. And that's what happened under Suharto, which led to one of the longest dictatorships in Southeast Asian history.
Right. And we'll talk a bit more later about the state of Indonesian democracy and its and its resilience. But it seems like, in at least in terms of the near-term future, Prabowo represents a challenge to the devolution of power and federalism and direct democracy in Indonesia, as opposed to the entire democratic system itself. Now, Prabowo himself is quite wealthy, and his brother Hashim is also a very wealthy man. Their net worth is somewhere in the hundreds of millions of dollars. His brother is far more wealthier. And they've used their own money to bankroll Prabowo's election campaigns. And this points towards a contradiction in Prabowo's public image. He has an aristocratic lineage. He's an oligarch, and he's also a populist. And forgive me for another potentially forced analogy, but it reminds me a bit of Trump. But I'd like you to talk to us about the connection between money and power in Indonesia, because it is one of the more unequal societies in Southeast Asia. And it seems like there is a bit of a void in terms of the country's politics. There's a demand for a responsive politics in a material sense, but the agents for delivery are politicians who are oligarchs or tools of oligarchs. So I'm wondering, has Indonesian politics been totally captured by oligarchs? And is there space for civil society and grassroots forces?
That's absolutely the argument, I'd say, the dominant academic argument in the field, which is that Indonesia's politics have been captured by oligarchs, or that Indonesian politics resembles an oligarchy. And I think there's two ways of thinking about that oligarchy. One is that actual oligarchs are within the political system, who have seen that they are better off shoring up their wealth through the political process by bankrolling political parties and running for elections and having their little parties engage in the transactional coalitional politics of Indonesian government. And they've been able to shore up their interests that way. But another way of thinking about oligarchy is as a relationship between what has been a very racialized economy in Indonesia, historically an incredibly racialized economy, in which a very small minority, an ethnic Chinese minority, dominate most of Indonesia's economic activity and top all of the sort of top 10 lists of Indonesians' most wealthiest. And they are embedded in relationships with a what's known as a pribumi, or an indigenous political elite. And that these kinds of relationships are what has dominated Indonesian politics throughout the New Order. I mean, the New Order really bedded down this system of joint enterprises and backing and protection between a sort of parasitic relationship between capital and politics. I think that has loosened up somewhat in the last 20 years under Reformasi, in which we see the pribumi elite, or the political elite, themselves become very serious oligarchs. And we're also seeing new sectors in which you see the rise of indigenous elites, for instance, in technology and other areas. Meanwhile, our ethnic Chinese oligarchs, who have long sought to capture the political elites, they have found new markets abroad. So we're seeing it's that traditional sense of oligarchy with this symbiotic relationship between politics and capital, while it is still very solid, I think, and it is still the dominant way in which politics works, we're certainly seeing it get more complicated, I guess, in its picture. But that is not proving to bring about better democracy or better outcomes for ordinary Indonesian people. Really, what it is doing is expanding the pool and making, I think, the fights between elites much more sharp and bitter. And that in itself tends to close off the political sphere as, I guess, warring economic and political elites utilize their whatever resources they have against each other. And I think what we see, I think, over the last, at least certainly over the last decade, is the kind of closing off of the national political space for this pool of incestuous, warring, intercompetitive, and also very aligned political and economic elites in Indonesia. And really, it does feel like a kind of a cartel effectively that runs the country. And really what you get in these coalitions that back up the president is just the same old figures backed by their own backers who also back everybody else. And they just sort of play a bit of musical chairs. And so certainly I think the national level politics has been closed off to ordinary people. Political parties and new political parties really struggle. The political party system is fundamental in keeping out change and keeping out new faces and turning efforts to make change, say the new Solidarity, Indonesian Solidarity Party, which was a real effort to reinvigorate reform, and drawing them into the kind of corrupt politics of this cartel. So that party is now very much aligned with the current and soon to be exiting President Joko Widodo. So I guess it's like you can't come into politics without playing the game of politics and therefore being tainted by it. And it's very, very difficult to see how national politics can change in this context when you have a party system and an oligarchy that polices this national space so fiercely.
Right. And on that subject of initially transformative political forces being transformed by the system itself, you know, Joko Widodo has initially came to power and was seen as an outsider, this non-elite politician. At least abroad, he was described as Indonesia's Obama, but in that period, I think at least the U.S. news media was trying to look for other Obamas in other parts of the world. It's a self-absorbed nature of how, you know, the U.S. media looks at the world. But I'm wondering, one, to what extent was that mythical? Because, you know, there's indication Joko was actually funded by oligarchs even before becoming president. And then, you know, since coming to power, he's been co-opted many of these elites, at least to, you know, survive in power and push forward his agenda. So what does that say about, you know, the possibilities of political change in Indonesia? Because Widodo has this tremendous popularity, somewhere close to 80%, according to the latest polls. But that star power and that public support hasn't really translated into a kind of ability to implement his own agenda without being tainted by these establishment forces.
I guess it's, you know, it is the absolute paradox that a political outsider like Jokowi, whose political career was honed and trained through the decentralized democracy system. So he was a mayor of Solo and became governor of Jakarta before he became president. So he came through the kind of provincial ranks, and this was seen as a way that the national political system would get fresh talent and fresh blood. And certainly Prabowo Subianto's competitors, Ganjar Pranowo, he is also a governor for Central Java, and Anies Baswedan was the governor for Jakarta. So there is certainly a sense from the parties that the fresh political talent is coming from the regions and through this process of regional democracy. But that is also a major threat to them, and which is part of the reason why I think the national political elite are souring against decentralized democracy. And Joko Widodo, I think, has often been seen as a man who is a reformer and a pro-democracy reformer, but who was thwarted by the national, this national political dynamic wherein kind of everyone gets drawn into these transactional politics. But I think Joko Widodo only ever had a very loose commitment to democracy, and he is himself a very instrumentalist political player. And it's worth noting that when Jokowi tried to push forward what is clearly his agenda, which is the neoliberalization reforms, these big bang deregulation reforms, plus a massive infrastructure agenda, which was very much supported by the community. But when he tried to push those, that what was clearly kind of his own pure agenda through, he often utilized deeply anti-democratic or anti-good governance means to do so. So I recall very clearly in 2014, him calling in, he's only been a few months in power at this stage. He still had the shine of the Southeast Asia's Obama to him. Civil society had huge hopes for him. And I remember this peculiar meeting where he calls in the head of the police, the head of the Attorney General, and the head of the Anti-Corruption Commission, which then was a commission that was fearsome and independent and was absolutely rigorous in their efforts to rid Indonesia with corruption. And he calls them in to the palace and explains to them that he will be embarking upon a massive infrastructure program and that they are not to touch his infrastructure projects. So he wants no independent investigations of corruption around his infrastructure projects. And as his term unfolded, it was certainly a no-go zone. I mean, prosecutors and investigators would talk about that all the time, that you could not touch one of the national infrastructure projects, despite the fact that there was enormous amounts of money being trafficked through those projects. It was also said that Jokowi enabled or allowed or turned a blind eye to somewhere with the value of 20 to 30% of those projects being siphoned off by predatory bureaucrats and the private sector. So Joko Widodo has this reputation, I guess, of a Democrat thwarted or a Democrat turned by a national political system that is so riddled with corruption. But I think he is a man who is deeply instrumentalist, is deeply transactional, and is ruthless in trying to gain what he, you know, in trying to pursue his own interests, and does not have very strong democratic norms by any means. So in many ways, Indonesian civil society is right in their feeling of being tricked, of being used and of being harnessed to his campaigns of pro-democracy when he himself has no interest in deepening Indonesian democracy.
Right. And we saw that, I think, earlier when he failed in his attempt to try to orchestrate a third term for himself. Now, during the course of these elections, Joko has transitioned toward becoming more of a kingmaker. His son ran as Prabowo's running mate. He's got another son who heads a small political party. And so he's assuming a role that's similar to other power brokers in Indonesia, controlling things behind the scenes. So it's very akin to Megawati, who is the daughter of another longtime ruler of Indonesia, Sukarno. And so I'm wondering, how likely is Jokowi's influence to endure post-presidency? He has the popularity, but does he have the money also?
That's a really good question. There's never been a sense that Jokowi himself has an asset base of oligarchical proportions. Nonetheless, he certainly has many different companies, and those companies are engaged in very deep relationships with oligarchical parties, ex-military, ethnic Chinese conglomerates, and what have you. He has certainly been careful to shore up, I guess, his family's economic prospects. But I don't know whether that's his driver. There's never been that sense that that's his driver. Will that money give him an ongoing role in politics? That's a very good question. I think at this point, he is banking on installing his two sons into national politics as a means by which of shoring up his legacy. And I think a lot of people have real questions about how effective that strategy is going to be, particularly facing off against a person like Prabowo Subianto, who is a long-term political player. And his sons, you know, I think the vice president, Gibran, is only around 37 and doesn't have much of a political background. And his other son, Kasaing, who heads up the small political party, I think they're barely going to make it into parliament. So their votes are not going to be instrumental in passing legislation. They're not going to be a powerful member of the Prabowo Subianto coalition. So it's hard to see what kind of levers and leverage the Jokowi, the sort of post-President Jokowi can utilize against Prabowo in order to keep him on track. I dare say Joko Widodo is not free from playing dirty. And in both the 2019 campaigns and the 2014 campaigns, there were very credible allegations that he was instructing his police and attorney generals to sort of manufacture or dig up old allegations of corruption against local elites in order to twist their hand to supporting his electoral campaign and in fact deliver certain numbers of votes. It may be that Joko Widodo has, you know, compromat against Prabowo Subianto, and that's why he believes that this pact between these two giants in politics is going to hold. I think, you know, it's anybody's guess, but certainly there will be points of tension, and it's a question of when will those points of tension arise and around what kinds of issue. Many people have said Joko Widodo is a fool to trust Prabowo Subianto and think that he can control a person like Prabowo Subianto. But Joko Widodo is a pretty fearsome political player in himself, and I have no doubt he's thought that through. So it's a question. We don't know what is going to transpire, but it'll certainly be a very interesting time for Indonesian politics. It's worth noting every time political elites of this stature engage in conflict, it's Indonesian democracy that is sacrificed in the, as elephants, you know, as elephants stomp, it's the mice that get crushed. So too is it Indonesian's quality of democracy that becomes eroded.
And speaking of the erosion of democracy in Indonesia, something has struck me as quite peculiar in terms of how the political system operates, especially in terms of coalition politics. So I've tried to map these relationships out, and it just seems like this confusing archipelago of political parties. And there seems to be a pattern, at least in the Jokowi era, of political parties and politicians running against one another, but then inevitably joining the government in some shape or form, at least through parliamentary coalitions. And it seems like Indonesia today, or at least in the Jokowi era, did not really have a real political opposition. So what explains all this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of politics of co-optation and everyone gets a little piece of the pie that really has dominated Indonesian politics all the way back to Suharto, in fact. And it was, in fact, the previous president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, who really brought in the idea of what was known as rainbow coalitions, that being most of the major political parties, and all political parties must be national, so there aren't sort of local political parties except for in the northernmost province of Aceh. And so you have these political parties, and there's only a few of them because they must be national, and they join the government coalition, leaving a very, very thin opposition of, say, 10 to 20%. And no party wants to be in opposition. There's no gain to be made from opposition. There's no reputational gain. There's very little interest in making government accountable. What everybody wants is to be part of the big fat rainbow coalition and have their little piece of the pie that will enable them to both pursue individual rent seeking and also to provide money back to the political party. So it is a very rare political party that will stomach opposition. And I doubt that we will see the competitors against Prabowo Subianto, the parties that competed against him, I doubt that we will see them hold out to become opposition. I imagine they will be looking for opportunities to join the government coalition. This coalitional, kind of these big broad coalitions, arguably are a constraint on presidents. You know, some people have said, oh, you know, they enable corruption, they enable unaccountable, lacking in transparent government, and they enable politics as usual to happen. And that's absolutely true, but it also means that they constrain the ability of presidents to act in discretionary and autonomous ways. And so some people are arguing that this kind of the Rainbow Coalition will also keep an authoritarian figure like Prabowo Subianto in check.
So we see these really conflicting indicators on the state of democracy in Indonesia. And you just talked about how these kind of mass coalitions emerge after elections and everyone wants to get a piece of the pie. But in spite of all that, elections remain competitive. A 2021 poll by the Lowy Institute shows that 60% of Indonesians say democracy is preferable to any form, other form of government. And that figure is largely unchanged since 2011. And so we have this sort of consistent support for democracy as a system over the past two decades. Election turnout is quite high. It's been in the 70 to 80% range over the past couple of decades. But at the same time, economic power is concentrated in the hands of the few. And those few dominate the political system as well, at least at the federal level. And then we have, you know, this issue of the potential for a middle income trap and a pause or an end to this cycle of growth that Indonesia has seen for the past couple of decades, you know, excluding the COVID pandemic and other interruptions. So I'm wondering, you know, when we talk about the status quo in Indonesia, in terms of this political order and the economic order, is it good enough to just muddle along, or is there a potential for an economic shock on the horizon that could shake up the political system like the country saw in 1998 with Reformasi?
I think it's a really great question. I think democracies around the world actually are muddling through, right? And they're inventing new ideological agendas and utilizing new wars on things, whether they be drugs or migrants or what have you, in order to distract the lower working class and the middle class from the fact that their material conditions are degrading, in fact. You know, we have property homeless crises all around the Western developed world. Here in Australia, an absolute rental crisis is hitting our middle class, and people are spending two-thirds of their income on rents. It's everywhere. And so then politics becomes the art of managing that conflict, that contradiction. And so it's about how long can the kind of the regime in power stir up trouble, distract, deny the reality of the experience of working people. And it turns out that they can do that for quite a long time, and that can be quite a durable system. I think under a person like Prabowo Subianto, who is very populist and authoritarian in his language, he is very able to utilize those rhetorical flourishes and political agendas against foreigners and what have you, to distract people from the fact that their material conditions are not improving. I think Joko Widodo also performed something of a magic trick by, you know, delivering, in fact, on infrastructure. You know, it's hard not to notice that you can get around Jakarta much better now that there is a kind of rail system that's functioning. And that when you go from Salatiga to Semarang, there's a brand new road. And these things tell you, oh, government's working. Even if my material conditions remain the same, there has been some transformation in my daily life. And so I think people can be deceived for a very long time. But it is a constant moving target. It's worth noting as well, in Indonesia, there's an amazing set of literature that maps the relationship between Islam and neoliberalism and the way that Islam has taken on almost Calvinist kind of connotations. And by that I mean this idea that, you know, as you work harder, you will get closer to God and you will reap the rewards of God. And I think that that has been an incredibly powerful ideological tool for many of the working class to keep them working, to keep them on that hamster wheel. So if they are not succeeding, despite the absolutely dreadful and parlous state of education and health and of workers' rights in Indonesia, it's because, you know, they're not working hard enough, they're not divine enough, God hasn't chosen them yet. And there's some incredible work being done with precarious populations and how religion is used to stymie and mystify their understanding of the material conditions in which they live. So I think this is a moving target and a problem for all democracies. I think we've seen in many regards the discrediting of the neoliberal global economy in terms of its ability to build a solid, safe middle class. And so all governments of democracies everywhere and of all stripes are racing around looking for new ideological tropes in order to distract the middle class from their worsening conditions and from the fact that the working poor are never going to make it, right? They're never going to make it in terms of their aspirations for middle class status.
That question of the relationship between piety, Islamic piety, and financial success, material success, could be a podcast on its own. And I think points towards a very distinctive Islamic culture in Southeast Asia, across the Indonesia, Malaysia region, and how religion plays an important role for the middle class. But there is also this economic aspiration element as well, and the two have fused together in a type of Islam that is very analogous to Calvinism, and so one may say that there's a Southeast Asian Muslim work ethic that is maybe formed there. Now, we're nearing the end of our show, and before I close, I just wanted to get to the question of Indonesia's role in the world. One thing that strikes me about Indonesia today, at least compared to its past, is that we don't really see it as an assertive geopolitical actor. So Indonesia's, has been well known, is well known for hosting the Bandung Conference, which paved the way for the non-aligned movement. In the past, there's also been irredentist tendencies among Indonesia's leadership with respect to Malaysia, with respect to East Timor. But now it seems like there's a shift in terms of the strategic culture as well as what the public wants. And it's very much a pragmatic Southeast Asian geopolitical actor, like many countries in the ASEAN region. Is that likely to continue under Prabowo?
Again, I think the kind of academic community is quite split on this. Many foreign policy analysts in the days leading up to the election argued that it would be it's very unlikely that Prabowo will upturn Indonesia's non-aligned status. And Indonesia's tendency to downplay its role on the international stage because it's so kind of consumed with domestic politics. I think that is largely true. I don't think we will see any large moves in that direction. But I think it's worth noting that Prabowo Subianto himself does regard himself as something of a foreign policy and defense expert, and certainly that's his background. And he has a tendency, and we saw this under the Jokowi Widodo government, of coming out occasionally with sort of off-piste foreign policy suggestions. He tried to broker, for instance, a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia without informing either the president or the foreign minister at a time in which Prabowo was really trying to curry the attention of the president. So it seemed almost a sort of contradictory or a poorly thought out move to kind of go off piste on his own and propose a whole new foreign policy without having actually consulted the president who he was trying to court. So I think Prabowo has certainly errs in that regard and believes his own strategic thinking in that regard. And I think we might see some surprises in terms of Indonesian foreign policy moving forward. But they will probably be more likely to be ad hoc and based on specific types of events and possibly also driven by domestic discontent rather than a wholesale strategic change. Certainly Indonesia continues to underplay its weight. It certainly doesn't cut a major figure on the international scene. And I don't think we will see Indonesia change in that regard. It's also worth noting, I mean, a lot of the question has been like, will Indonesia, where will it sit in terms of this great power conflict, right, between potentially the US and China? I mean, Indonesia is very dependent on Chinese funding for its infrastructure, and Prabowo, for all of his sovereignty populism, has not in any way countered or rejected that flow of funding, despite, you know, all the kind of debates, and some of them are overblown, but about sort of debt trap diplomacy and what have you that comes out of China funding infrastructure. And also it's worth noting that when Indonesian or ordinary Indonesian interests conflict with Chinese funded infrastructure, Prabowo has also been very, very quiet. So again, while he certainly has principles and ideas that he believes he is right to voice, he's also a very tactical and instrumentalist politician whose principles will fall by the wayside when it suits him.
Right. And final question for our listeners who may be interested in learning more about Indonesia and Indonesian politics. Do you have any books that you'd like to recommend for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So am I allowed to pick some fiction books?
Yeah. Fiction's fine.
Man Tiger by Eka Kurniawan made the long list of the Booker Prize. I think it's Eka Kurniawan is Indonesia's most well-regarded international writer. And I had the pleasure over summer to reread Man Tiger. And it's an incredible read right up to the last line. And what I love about Indonesian fiction is it paints Indonesia so well, and it gets to the heart of why this is a country of such great contradictions and a country that is so easy to fall in love with. I mean, for all the discussion we've had today about Indonesia's democracy degrading and the popular vote going to an authoritarian populist, you know, in my own life, I think Indonesia and Indonesians have taught me more about democracy than I ever have learned from living in a Western democracy. Indonesians love democracy. They are, I think, a deeply democratic people who have the capacity to think in new ways and bring together new political visions. And I think that's better captured in fiction than it is in nonfiction, unfortunately, perhaps because of the poor record that Indonesian radicalism has, I guess, in on the national political stage. Another book that I thought was, again, summed up those paradoxes and those contradictions of Indonesia was a book called Birth Canal, which has just come out by a writer called Dias Novita Wuri, which is about, I won't spoil it for your audience, but it's a really shocking book about women's bodies. And it comes to, you know, for a country, the largest Muslim country in the world, that is kind of presumed to have certain gender relations, I think Birth Canal really upturns everything you ever thought about gender in Indonesia. Two other nonfictions, I guess, for an audience looking to learn more about Indonesia. These two were written by foreigners. Elizabeth Pisani's Indonesia, Etc. is a fantastic read, a real page-turner. And also Vincent Bevan's The Jakarta Method, which was an excellent book about the impact of US foreign policy on countries and their developmental trajectories, including Indonesia. And Vincent really draws in ordinary stories into this kind of vast geopolitical Cold War that he narrates.
And that was Dr. Jackie Baker of Murdoch University. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.